I'm here with John Rees today on the 5th anniversary since Egypt's revolution. So John was there when it was happening this time 5 years ago. What were your most distinct memories from what was happening during that revolution?
Well, the old order, the old Mubarak state, had really effectively broken down. The mass of the people were in charge of the streets in Cairo. For instance, all the major traffic intersections were controlled by groups of protesters. They were directing traffic, they were seeing who came in, who went out. The army was effectively refusing to act against the protesters. And although Mubarak didn't fall until the 25th of January, and there were moments in the 18 days of protest in Tahrir Square when it looked as if the right wing might regain control, for instance, the vigilantes associated with the regime on the so-called Day of the Camels, because they all charged into Tahrir Square, some of them on camels, and tried to drive all the protesters out of the square. They themselves were then pushed back. There was a kind of running fight with them, that the Cairo Football Supporters Clubs came down and were part of that battle to drive the right wingers, the vigilantes, out of the square. But in general, it was an incredible time, because there would be tanks parked on the outskirts of the square on the major intersections, but the people actually controlling the traffic in the intersections would be the protesters. Mm. And then, of course, there were constantly huge demonstrations of millions of people pouring into Tahrir Square, holding Tahrir Square, rammed back into the streets for half a mile around the square, meetings taking place, stages being erected with sound systems all around the square, and yet at the same time a kind of air of menace. There would be the regime's helicopters flying low over the square. There was a day when Mubarak actually ordered the aircraft to open fire on the protesters, but they flew over the square and didn't in fact open fire. So there was
an odd relationship between the military and the protesters.
Yes, yeah. Indeed. So there was a kind of sense that the popular movement had taken control of the society, but at the same time the armed forces and the core of the state was still visibly present on the streets as well.
So some people say that this came out of nowhere, and others say, well, it was brewing, it was meant to happen. What were the main reasons that people in Egypt felt like they needed to...
Yeah, it definitely did not come out of nowhere. I mean, one of the reasons why I was there is because I'd been involved with the opposition movement in Egypt for years beforehand, and at the time that we held the big 2003 demonstration against the Iraq war, there was something, an anti-war conference called the Cairo Conference, and that happened most years, nearly every year, between 2002 and the revolution, and that became a kind of organising centre. The Muslim Brotherhood were involved in it, Arabs would come to it. It was one of the launch bases for the Kifaya Enough democracy movement. So anybody involved in that knew that there was a long tail of protests. In fact, in 2003 is the only other time, the anti-war protest in Egypt at that time is the only other time when Tahrir Square was taken by a movement of popular protest. And that was called the Hyde Park Intifada, because it was after the big demonstrations that we held in Hyde Park. So no, there was a long process of opposition building up to the Egyptian revolution, and of course immediately before it, in December, the Tunisian revolution had already taken place, and that definitely was a kind of signal to the Egyptians to move.
So do you think that it was expected, and Mubarak knew that this was going to happen and almost anticipated it? And was there much of a left presence in Egypt before this happened? And how much did the revolution change politics within Egypt?
I think the Mubarak regime, like many dictatorships, is paranoid, distrusts any sign of, and rightly distrusts any sign of popular movement. It was an incredibly repressive police apparatus. When we would hold protests just on the steps of the journalist syndicate in downtown Cairo, where the Cairo Conference was held every year, there would be ranks of riot police and riot police vehicles all the way around. The very first protest that we held about the invasion of Iraq was outside the Qatari embassy. There were only about 100 of us. You can't set up a stage or have a PA, so the protesters literally lift you onto their shoulders and you make a speech from somebody's shoulders to the crowd. Both myself and George Galloway, who was there at the time, made those speeches. And when you were making it, you were looking directly down the barrel of the gun of an armoured car that was parked around the protest. So the Mubarak regime was constantly aware of this. It's a brief kind of moment where it opened up slightly the elections to the fake parliament, and some Muslim Brotherhood MPs were elected, was clamped down on very quickly, and those MPs were arrested and jailed. So yes, it was very, very aware of that. I think lots of people felt that society was on the edge, that the tensions within it were unsustainable, but you never know until it happens when it's going to happen.
So when Mubarak was overthrown, you said you explained the scene like a carnival, it was like a party. And how long did this feeling last for? Did the Egyptians get the freedom that they were finally promised?
In a way, and for a period, yes. I mean, the day that Mubarak fell was an incredible moment, because that kind of paralysis between the armed forces and the regime and the popular movement was present right up until the last moment. There was a demonstration in Tahrir Square, but there were also demonstrations at other places, at the Abdeen Palace, at the TV centre. I went on one of the breakaway demonstrations that went down to the TV centre, and it met a certain point, a line of tanks blocking the road, and there was a moment where it halted. And then it simply went forward and climbed over the tanks. And at that moment, you were never sure what was going to happen at that moment. And as a matter of fact, the troops and the tanks just sat there as the protesters kind of overran it. I was moving towards, with a group of friends of Egyptians, up towards the other protest at the Abdeen Palace, when I was suddenly grabbed by a military patrol who took my passport and were taking me off. And it wasn't until my friends started shouting to people in the street and they got a crowd around me and stopped the soldiers taking me away and got my passport back. Otherwise, I think I'd have probably been the last person arrested under Mubarak, because then within hours the regime fell and there was an absolutely huge party, not only in Tahrir Square but for, you know, half a mile in the streets around Tahrir Square. And there were huge stages in Tahrir of the different groups. I got up on the stage that the Revolutionary Left had, and it was just an incredible party going on in the square, and that lasted for some time. And of course, what it did establish was, you know, it broke the old dictatorship. You know, it broke the Mubarak dictatorship. It did pave the way for elections, the elections in which the Muslim Brotherhood were the single biggest gainers, and eventually Mohamed Morsi became president. So it broke for a period the dictatorship and replaced it with an imperfect but nevertheless parliamentary regime. So Egyptians got a certain degree of freedom, an important degree of freedom, which they'd never had before, and which has now been taken away by the Council Revolution, by the rise of el-Sisi.
So have you been back to Egypt?
I went back a couple of times. I've been back a few times since the revolution, in the period where that freedom existed. I haven't been back since the coup. I don't think it would be safe for me to do so, partly because some of the speeches that I made here in London were very widely broadcast by Al Jazeera in Egypt at the time. And if you look what happens to, well, the Al Jazeera journalists themselves famously, but to many, many journalists now in Egypt, I think the chances of arrest would be very high. Well, that's certainly what my Egyptian friends tell me. It's actually a very sad thing not to be able to go back. And, I mean, obviously, you know, it's nothing in comparison to what the Egyptians themselves are suffering, which is, you know, thousands of people arrested, tortured, killed in the demonstrations that preceded the coup.
Would you say that it was almost a price that they had to pay in order for that to happen?
The price
of, you know, people in the protest being killed, the violence.
No, I think the terrible thing about the coup, the counter-revolution, is that it could have been avoided. I think the Muslim Brotherhood were much too eager to accommodate to the regime. They thought that because they had parliamentary power, they had real power, whereas most people who studied capitalist societies know It's been said of Labour governments in this country, but it's true of every government in a capitalist economy, that you're in government but you're not in power. Mm-hmm. And the deep state, as it's called in Egypt, is the real power. And the real power is the big corporations and the army. And often they're the same thing. The army, unlike the army, say, in Britain, is a huge economic stakeholder. It produces bottled water, it produces cement, it lays roadway. It's an economic actor in its own right. And that was never going to simply go away just because Mubarak had gone. It wasn't simply going to go away because some people had won the election. And the Muslim Brotherhood government compromised far too easily with that state. All you've got to know is that Field Marshal al-Sisi was appointed to his job by Mohamed Morsi. So when you appoint your own executioner, you're probably doing something wrong.
What is it that we can do here as political activists to try and help the situation of people in Egypt today?
Well, obviously there are moments when solidarity is necessary, when journalists are arrested, when there is international protest. That's always an important direct form of solidarity. I think keeping an accurate history of how the revolution happened and how it was defeated is important as well, not just for Egyptians but for everybody. They face these problems in a specifically Egyptian form, but they're general problems that any mass movement that challenges power will face. And to learn from the Egyptian experience as well as others is a way of paying proper respect to what those activists did. And finally, the most important duty for every socialist is to deal with their own ruling class first and foremost. I'm all for international solidarity, and that's why we were involved in the Cairo Conference. It's why I was in Cairo 5 years ago. But I've never thought that solidarising with people over there can be as effective as us dealing with our ruling class here. Mm-hmm. If we do that effectively, it inspires other people in other countries far more than any act of solidarity can do. So our first duty is always to take on that element of what is anyway an international ruling class that is on our patch of land that we can most directly affect. As I say, the big demonstration, the anti-war demonstration in Cairo in 2003, was partly inspired by what we'd done in London. And to this day, activists in Cairo will tell you that. So that's how real solidarity works. Yes, as much as we can do to directly support other people's struggles, but the thing that we can really do is set an example by taking on effectively our own rulers here.